Well, can I have your attention, everybody? My turn now. I'm not even going to ask you how much you enjoyed the lectures of Christine Hayes, because I know that you did. And the very next morning after she left, she wrote us in the office a very lovely letter appreciating the warm hospitality that she enjoyed in Portland. Just one word, because we're going to finish up the story of David. While I had a chance to chat with her, I said, you know, you and I have very strongly different opinions about King David. And she said, oh? A very eloquent comment, by the way. And I said, yes. I said, in your book, and I used the word that she used in her book, you described David as being Machiavellian in the way that he treated the family of Saul, that it was all intended in order to strengthen his own rule rather than concern for the family of Saul. And I interpreted that he really was very sincere out of a very young sense of reverence for the first king of Israel, chosen by God, and that he really felt that way about the family. So she said, I have a very simple answer to you. I was the prosecuting attorney, and you were the defense attorney. Which is such a wise way of putting it. There's lots to be said on both sides of the picture. Anyway, I want to say a few final words about David. One of the greatest tragedies of his life came towards the end of his life, when he totally lost control over his own children, to the point where his son Absalom revolted against him and actually waged war against him, so that David had to flee to escape his own son Absalom. And then Joab, who was David's general and totally devoted to him, pursued against Absalom, and that famous story of Absalom's hair being caught in the branches of a tree. He was hanging there helpless, and Joab killed him on the spot. We read in Samuel 2, chapter 19, first verse. The king trembled, that's David. He ascended to the upper chamber of the gateway and wept. And thus he said as he wept, my son Absalom, Absalom, if only I could have died in your place, my son Absalom, my son. That was one of the most painful expressions of grief that a father could say about a child, if I could only have died in your place. Now, Absalom was not his child. Or he was his child, rather, but Absalom was in the process of waging war against David. And Joab was faithful to David and killed Absalom. And yet, the pain that he had was so great, as expressed in these words. And then on top of that, he has other children. The oldest one is Adonijah. Adoniyahu. And Adonijah can't wait until his father dies. He's already very old and apparently without any physical or mental strength. So Adonijah, on his own, appoints Joab, the very same Joab, to be his commander-in-chief. And has himself proclaimed as king. And every very large gathering joined together and shouted, "Hail Adonijah, King of Israel." David is not even aware of what's happening. He's that physically so decrepit. And of all things, two people plan to undo the premature declaration of Adonijah as king. Who were they? That really is an odd couple. It's part of the wonderful storytelling of the writer of this story. One is Bathsheba. Understandable. Bathsheba has already paid a price for her affair with David. The child that was produced as a result of that liaison died. But she had another child, and they named him Solomon. She understood that God had told her that her son Solomon would become the king. But it's undone. Adonijah has already become the king. She is joined by, of all people, Nathan. Remember Nathan. He's the one who came to David and denounced him for having this affair with Bathsheba. Remember the famous story he told David to convince him how wrong he was about the wealthy man and the poor man, and a great visitor was coming, and the wealthy man who had hundreds of sheep didn't want to use any of his sheep to prepare a festive meal for his guest. So he picks the only sheep of the poor man and uses that sheep for the festive meal. And Nathan tells that story to David. And David is so angry, he said, "Oh, that person should die for doing a thing like that." And Nathan says to him, "You are that person. You took the only wife of Uriah and sacrificed him because you wanted Bathsheba. But the two of them come to David and they say to David, David, do you know what's going on? Adonijah has just proclaimed himself king, and everybody is cheering. And God has promised that Solomon would become the king. Do something. Well, David could easily have said, it's too late. In my condition, I can't do much of anything. But he didn't do that. He aroused himself and went out to the public to proclaim that he has appointed Solomon as king. If you want to look at interesting twists in literature, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the fact in the Bible, Adonijah couldn't do anything about David's will. Solomon became the king. So what does Adonijah do? He comes to Bathsheba and he says to her, I give up. I was wrong. I shouldn't have taken the step I did. And David was right in establishing Solomon as king. I give up. I only have one request. What in the world did he request? When David became old, everybody thought that he needs a caregiver. I'm very familiar with that problem. But the Bible describes the caregiver as being the most beautiful woman in Israel. I am not familiar with that solution. But Abishag was appointed as his caretaker, as the Bible puts it, to keep him warm. Adonijah said, well, David has died. Could I have Abishag as my caregiver? And Bathsheba says, why not? I'll arrange it. So she goes to Solomon and she said, you know, your brother Adonijah has forfeited the kingdom, and his only one request, he's fallen in love with Avishag and wants her as his caregiver. Would you do that for him? Solomon says, why not? And then proceeds to instruct his own commander-in-chief to kill Adonijah because it represents a plot that he has if he's taking over David's caregiver. It's a way of moving towards taking over the kingdom itself. So that was the end of Adonijah. So now we have Solomon under those circumstances. Now we read the last wishes of David. Kings 1, chapter 2. Okay. King David's days draw near to die, and he instructed his son Solomon, saying, "I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong and become a man. Safeguard the charge of God, to walk in his ways, to observe his decrees, commandments, ordinances, and testimonies as written in the Torah of Moses, so that you will succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn, so that God will uphold his word that he spoke regarding me, saying, 'If your children will safeguard their way to walk before me sincerely with all their heart and all their soul, saying, "No man of yours will ever be cut off upon the throne of Israel."'" So far, so good. That's a wonderful sort of final ethical will that he's giving his son. Be faithful to God so that God's promise will be fulfilled, that my dynasty will exist forever. But now he adds on this codicil, which is pure David. "Furthermore, you know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me, what he did to two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner and to Amasa, whom he killed, shedding blood of war in peacetime, and placing the blood of war in the girdle that is on his loins and on his shoes that are on his feet. You shall act according to your wisdom. Do not allow his white hair to go down to the grave in peace." Pure David. He doesn't tell him what to do, but he winks so hard, his eyelashes must have stuck to his chin. "Do what you have to do," and he does. Joab, who has really dedicated his entire life to David, but he doesn't mention it here, and I'm not going to explain why not, because I don't know why not. I think the real reason that he was so angry with Joab was that he killed Absalom. No matter what else he did for David, it doesn't count. And he goes on with another one or two such remarks. So that's the story of David, and now we turn to Solomon. Now, Solomon is in an ideal situation. In this sense, and we know this very clearly from all of the historical work that has been done in the Middle East. You know the phrase, timing is everything. Solomon lived at a perfect time. Namely, at a time when the kingdom or the rulers of Egypt were at a very low ebb in ability and power. At a time when Babylonia was at a very low ebb in terms of powerful leadership, military leadership. No outside power could affect Solomon in what he wanted to do. David was constantly carrying on war to create this powerful nation. Solomon didn't have to fight one single war against anybody. All he had to do, which he did with alacrity, was to build up a great, powerful army. The Bible says that he had a cavalry of 1,200 horses imported from Egypt. He built mighty fortified cities. A number of tourists to Israel to this day, one of the highlights of their tours to Israel are places like Hazor and Megiddo in the north. Another show of hands. How many of you who have traveled to Israel have been there? Huh? Number of hands. Raise your hand, Tanette, because you've been there. These are mighty fortresses in the north. The north was very important because the north was the gateway to the land of Israel from the Fertile Crescent. He built a mighty wall all around Jerusalem. And he built the most important wall of all in Jerusalem, the wall around the temple. He built a temple, which devotes a great deal of attention in the Bible to the magnificence of the temple. Well, I tell you, when we talk about magnificence, the temple in Jerusalem doesn't hold a candle to the temples in Egypt and Babylonia, because they were really wealthy countries, with the Nile and the Euphrates providing the foundation for the greatest agriculture of the world at the time. But when they are at a low ebb, the temple in Jerusalem stood out as a magnificent building. It was, but compared to them, it was mini-sized. But he built the temple, he built the walls. In the south, he built a fleet of vessels to go down to the Red Sea and beyond to the Orient, bringing fabulous trade to the land of Israel. Remember, the story tells about the visit of the Queen of Sheba, came from Arabia. This was not a visit of a neighbor going there for a spa or something like that. This was a trade exchange between Israel and Arabia, bringing to Israel all the great wealth in Africa, in Arabia, from the south. He worked very closely with Hiram, the king of Tyre, along the coast of the Mediterranean in what is today Lebanon, in what used to be called Phoenicia. They controlled all of the seagoing trade of the Mediterranean, bringing in all of the goods of southern Europe, northern Africa, to Phoenicia, to Israel, and from there to the Fertile Crescent and back. Solomon was the center of a tremendous amount of trade. He had hundreds and hundreds of wives. They were not a reflection of his sexual powers. They were parts of the treaties, trade treaties, that he established with all of the countries of the Middle East. Now, when you have those wives, and you have these relations with these countries, it involves an enormous amount of building. Temples, so that these wives could have a place to worship their gods. Facilities for representatives from those countries, like what we call today embassies. So Jerusalem became the hub of an enormous amount of structures built to support this whole system that was established by Solomon. Wealth became the dominant essence of thought in the land of Israel. Solomon was able to introduce this enormous class division in Israel. The very wealthy and the very poor. In order to get labor, you harness people to serve, to build, to cut down the trees in order to provide the wood, to mine the copper in order to provide the minerals that were necessary. It was a very bustling, very successful, highly economically profitable country that Solomon ruled. I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about one aspect of Solomon, because I think it has a message for us today. So I hope that you hear me out, not that you have a choice. One of the things that Solomon is most praised for is his wisdom. So there is ascribed to him two wisdom books of the Bible. One of them is the book of Proverbs, which is a book of wisdom. The other is the book of Ecclesiastes. There is also ascribed a Song of Songs, but that's in a different kind of wisdom. And he is described in the Bible as being very, very wise. And the familiar story that we know about in the Bible to show his wisdom, remember the story of the two women who gave birth to two babies at the same time, two baby boys. During the night, one of those babies died. The next morning, each mother claimed that her baby was the one that survived and that it was the other baby that died. You remember that story? Of course. It's a conundrum. So they come before the wise king, who has to decide which is the real mother of the living child and which is not. What he does is call for the sword, his royal sword, to be brought. He brings the two mothers in front of him. And then he asks them, "Are you the mother of the living child?" Each one says yes. "Are you the mother of the dead child?" Each one says no. So I'll tell you what he says I'll do. I'm going to take the sword and slice the child in half and give each of you a half. Will you be satisfied?" One of them screams, "No, no, no." And then the other one says, "Justice is justice. Solomon said, I know who the real mother is of the living child. No mother would allow her child to be slaughtered that way." He's so wise, isn't he? But is he? Now I want to tell you a bit of the Talmud, the very first Talmud that I ever studied in my life. I was about 11 years old. It was in Akron, Ohio. I didn't realize it at the time when my teacher selected the part of the Talmud that I would study first in my life was the same part of the Talmud that was taught first in the life of every Jewish child in the world in years past. I tried it out this morning. My son Shaul is visiting. And I said to Shaul, "What was the first piece of Talmud that usually was studied by Jews throughout history?" He answered immediately, "It's the book of Baba Metzia." The first words of Baba Metzia. And he even told me those words. But I have to tell you, I remembered those words better than he did. They were ingrained in my mind. And here are the words. That's how Baba Metzia starts. Shnayim ochzim betalit. Ze omer ani mitzaiha, veze omer ani mitzaiha. Ze omer kulo shali, veze omer kulo shali. זהי שווה שאין לו פחות ממחצה, וזהי שווה שאין לו פחות ממחצה, ויחלוקו. Do I need a translation? Okay. Two people are holding a garment. One of them says, I found it. And the other one says, I found it. One of them says, it's all mine. And the other one says, it's all mine. One of them has to swear, I do not possess of this garment any less than one half. And the other one has to swear, I do not possess of this garment less than one half. And they divide it. Then the Talmud goes on, which I'm not going to discuss with you today, why the questioning went in that way. But that was the substance of the inquiry. And then the Talmud goes on to say, what do you mean they divide it? If they cut it in half, it's worthless. It's not worth anything to anybody. What it means is, the garment is sold, and the value of the garment, which is the money that it would which it would get, the money was divided between the two people. What the Talmud really was doing was refining and changing the wisdom of Solomon. The so-called wisdom of Solomon was very clear. As I already pointed out, no real mother would allow her child to be cut in half just on the basis of whose child it's going to be. But the Talmud reasoned that's not the only solution, and it's not even necessarily a good solution. What if neither one of them is the mother? What if one of them is kind-hearted and the other doesn't care? Does that really solve the question? So what the Talmud is talking now is about a garment, not a human life. As long as it's a garment, it can be sold, and the value can be placed on it, and the money can be divided without anybody being hurt. But when life enters into the picture, it's a very different story. I think that's an important lesson for today. And I beg your forgiveness for even introducing this thought. But I wanted to share it with you. Pretty much that's the big problem in the United States today. The wall. You either want to build a wall or you don't want to build a wall. You either want to spend $5.7 billion or you don't want to spend $5.7 billion. So you have a difference of opinion. That's like the case of Solomon. If you solve the problem like Solomon did, you do exactly what Trump is doing. You put people's lives at stake. You have the shutdown of the government. People do not have a living wage. during a whole month and more. Their lives are, at the least, deeply disrupted. But the idea being, if you stick to it, you're going to win. Basically, holding people's lives as a ransom. That was not the approach of the Talmud. The approach of the Talmud was, you cannot bring human lives into the equation. The equation has to remain what it is, stark. You want this thing, you want this thing, you claim it, you claim it, you have to divide. So the thought occurred to me, the whole idea of the Talmud is that it revisits the Bible and addresses the problems raised by the Bible in much more intelligent and rational terms. This whole business with the wall could be solved simply by putting some kind of a value on it. That value has already been placed. Give in to part of that value in the case of the Talmud section, it was half and half. So you have to give in $2.something billion. It's not going to be destructive to the American economy. But at the same time, people's lives will be spared that enormous issue that they now face. So I would suggest that our government examine the story of Solomon and the Talmud of Baba Metzia and end this ridiculous crisis. My whole point is to show that we can really learn something from the Talmud, and that the Bible teaches many, many wonderful things, but we always have to bear in mind that the Bible was written at a time when the world was radically different. Now, David was king, and Solomon was king. David had the power and exercised that power to take the life of anyone that he disagreed with. Anyone. That was his last act. To take the life of Joab, because Joab did what he did not like. Solomon had the power as king to take the life of anyone, even to hold a sword above a small innocent baby and threaten to slice that baby in half. He was king, he could do it. The Talmud was written at a time when we did not have kings, individuals who could exercise that power in order to enforce their will. So we had to find other ways. We had to exercise our imagination and our brain to find solutions to those problems, because they exist. And I think in all of Jewish history, we have learned a great deal from the Talmud. For as far as I'm concerned, we have learned a great deal more in terms of our life from the Talmud than we have from the Bible. But we still treasure the study of the Bible from what we do learn from there. So we're now finished with Solomon. We now have a nation that is strong, independent, wealthy, but internally split up. All of the wealth that Solomon accrued went to Jerusalem and the southern area of the country. Taxes were being paid by everybody in Israel. Manpower was being drawn upon throughout Israel. And the seeds were planted for the breakup of the nation in the very first generation after Solomon, with the accession of his son Rehoboam, that we're going to talk about next week. So the signs are already there during Solomon's times. He absolutely didn't have the faintest vision of that taking place. He died perfectly happy, complacent, and reassured that everything is going to remain as wonderful as it is on this day that I die. So we'll take that up next week. Okay, now any comments or questions about anything that I said? You don't have much time anyway.
Rabbi?
Yes. Yes?
So next year, will you teach Talmud?
All I can say is I would love to, and it's possible. Okay, yes?
The Song of Songs. You mentioned the Song of Songs.
Yes. No, it's supposed to be attributed to Solomon. Solomon is supposed to be the key figure in the Song of Songs. Sherry?
So, given what we've heard about the personality and the behavior of David, why is he so admired and revered in all of our stories and in our
Well, that's a question I've asked myself many times. The answer, as far as I'm concerned, is David accomplished what no one in Jewish history accomplished until our own times. David created a powerful nation of Israel through military victory. Saul came close, but certainly not extensively as David. The fact that David had Joab to do the work is almost totally forgotten, because the credit goes to the one in charge. So, the dream of the Jew ever since the Jew went into exile was to once again have a strong, independent nation in Israel. The only one that I can think of in modern times for sure is David Ben-Gurion's position in the thinking of the Jewish people today. Believe me, Ben-Gurion had a lot of faults. They're almost totally overlooked for what he accomplished. That's a sort of a small example of King David. Again, it's the timing that's important. Okay, thank you very much.